Welcome to Limited Time Only.
I'm Esther.
And I'm Susie.
Limited Time Only is the podcast for anyone who feels there aren't enough hours in their life.
And each week, there's a different topic for you to get your ears around.
Featuring chat, comedy sketches, and interviews with interesting people.
Limited Time Only is a pick-me-up in podcast form.
The special guest later in the episode is Steve Lamack. This week, it's time for Radio Classics.
It's a bit different today on Limited Time Only. We're going to emulate a famous and long-running BBC Radio 4 programme. No, not the one I'm in. Although one day, hopefully. This one, the theme tune goes...
You're a beat behind me, Suze.
I was much higher than you. So bad.
I mean, basically, we're doing this episode because we want to be on Desert Island Discs, so we don't know whether we'll get it, and it's limited time only, so we're cracking on with it now. Just making our own.
We're just, yeah, making our own version of all the programmes we'd like to be
in. Yes, expect an episode of Vicar of Dibley next week.
This is a great idea. Then we'll have fulfilled all our ambitions. They could just go and live on an actual desert island and be happy.
Absolutely.
Esther, we've cracked it.
We've cracked it. We've worked out the formula for life.
Right, so on today's episode of Almost Desert Island Discs,
yes.
Sandy Island Records, I'm joined by Dame Esther Stanford.
Oh my God, are we doing me first? I'm really excited.
World famous actress, writer, producer, director, guru.
Multi-billionaire, philanthropist, giver to the masses.
Gardener.
Yeah, I might have staff for that, to be honest.
Well, true.
I'm going to be
You can design it. An all-round lovely person.
Thank you, darling.
She's here today to share with us a little tiny bit of her life story. Because we're aware we haven't got as long as on Desert Island Discs. And also, yeah, the obvious.
Yeah. Do you know what? I found this so hard. I went full... Do you remember that episode of Friends when Ross has to choose five women he might like to sleep with? And he gets really uptight about it and he takes ages and then he laminates the list. That was basically me with this.
Really?
I have gone back and forth. I've overanalyzed it. I've overthought it. I said to Ian last night, oh God, I just can't decide on these final songs. And he said,
really?
Well, he said, you've got to just have a story. And it doesn't. And I said, but I don't know if I'd want to listen to that. So I got a bit uptight about
it. Well, it's going to be great. And it is very interesting because I've had the exact opposite attitude.
Oh, really?
To it. Yeah.
Oh, no, I think it tells me quite a lot about my personality. And both of my kids say to me, because when they used to watch a lot of Friends, that I am basically Ross and Monica combined with a touch of Chandler thrown in, which I think is actually a really good...
I think that's a good combo.
Yeah, I think, well, they're both quite highly strung and they both are quite particular and, neurotic.
Yeah,
make jokes and Chandler just drops the jokes in. But... yes, so I've got my songs, which I decided, well, first of all, my first song is Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones.
Oh,
and when
yes.
I was 14, I went and did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival with ITV Workshop. I went with the oldest group, who were all around 18 years old, and we did The Two Gentlemen of Verona, but we updated it and it was modern, and I was the youngest by quite a way, and we went and we lived for 2 weeks in Edinburgh, and it was the most amazing experience of my life. And we were one of them, and I was really, you wouldn't do this nowadays, but we were given the pass to the nightclub in for the act,
the Fringe
for the performers
club. Yeah,
the Fringe Club. So we were given the pass for the Fringe Club, and because I was under 16, I had to leave at midnight, whereas everybody else could stay as late as they wanted. There were a couple of 16-year-olds there with me. And one night we were all on the dance floor and I'd never heard it before, but this woo-woo came on and everybody on the dance floor was just leaping in the air and singing along. I didn't know what it was, which is actually really weird because my dad used to... be a civil servant, but he used to sell records on the side and is so music based. So I knew a lot of the Stone songs, but I'd never heard it. And so I remember asking a friend, what is this song? And then coming home and learning the lyrics and just really, really loving it. And it was such a, it was like a real moment of where I was sort of borderline an adult and I was having this incredible experience. Yeah. Anyway, flash forward to, I think it was 2017, our friend Sally, who was a guest on the show, is married to, now married to Ronnie Wood. And she invited us to Paris to go and be VIP guests to the Rolling Stones, which still sounds like the most ridiculous thing you could ever say. And I told Sally this and we had the most amazing time. It was me and Susie, her mum, my husband, our friend Sarah and her husband, and Ross, a gang of us. And it was the most incredible, incredible experience. It was like something out of a film. But we went and we watched them and I told Sally this story and we went to the George Sank Hotel before we went to the concert. There was like... Tim Rice was there. So Tim Rice, there was...
Annika Rice. Anyone with the surname Rice.
Any form of Rice. Jay Jagger, Bobby Gillespie from Primal Scream. There were loads of amazing people there. It was kind of a mind-blowing thing. And we got driven there and then we stood at the front and Sympathy for the Devil came on and Sally came and grabbed my hand because she knew it was such a monumental song for me. And then afterwards, at the end of the concert... As we were coming to an end, we'd been told, hadn't we, that if we wanted to go back on the coaches, we'd have to miss the last three songs or we could make our own way back to the George Sank. And then Sally came and grabbed us and said, if you run, you can come in the fleet of Stones cars. Sorry, I've got a frog today. You can come in the fleet of Stones cars. So we ran, got in the fleet of Stones cars and then were driven... at 100 miles an hour through Paris, police escorted in the fleet of Stones cars. And then we got back to the hotel and we sat with Ronnie and I told him, I said, when I was 14, I listened to Sympathy for the Devil in this club and it was this life-changing experience. And tonight you've played it and I've heard it.
Yeah.
And it was just...
live. I mean...
oh, my God. And yeah. I'm sitting talking to Ronnie Wood about it. And it was like this real full circle moment. Yeah. And it was just... it was just like just the most incredible thing. And what an experience. What an experience.
Yeah, amazing.
Just incredible. We were so lucky to have that. I can't... when I tell people, I start laughing because it doesn't sound real.
It's completely ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, it was fantastic. That's such a great story. That's so lovely.
So my second track is a bit of a new addition for me. It's not something that I would normally choose. I based my tracks on how I would feel on the island, what I'd actually want to listen to.
You thought about it way more.
And how I'd feel when I got off. Oh, I went deep, oh, yeah. Suze. This is why it took me so long. I was like, right, I'm not going to want to stay there very long. I don't want to listen to anything too maudlin. I'm going to try and get out like Tom Hanks did in Castaway. Okay. So I thought about it in quite a different way, which is very interesting. So my second track is, you went on Steve Lamacq's Roundtable.
I did.
More than once.
I've been on it twice. Just...
Susie and Steve sitting in a tree talking about music.
Oh, love it. Love it.
And you listen to a track called Bayana by Naya Archives or Nia Archives. I don't actually know how you say it. And it was an African track over drum and bass. Now, I am not a drum and bass girly. I'm like, I'd go house music all the time. I like house music. But this song played and I felt... oh my God, it's sort of like African singing. And then there's this really hard beat underneath it. And it made me feel sort of quite, I don't know, electric. Oh. Very different to what I'd normally like to. But I do like group singing. I do like when I hear a group, particularly gospel singing and stuff like that. I love it. Anyway, loved it. And then I went to our friend Guru Sue's breathwork session. And people think when you do breathwork that it's probably a little, if you haven't done it, you can assume it might be a bit meditation-y or quite quiet. But what she does, because you're releasing, you sort of do this Wim Hof breathing for an hour. She puts music on very, very loudly because some people are crying. Some people start screaming. It sounds terrifying. It's not. It's actually... I've never really done drugs. I smoked a bit of pot, but I never did anymore because I was always scared I'd be the bugger that died. So, but I imagine it's what it feels like to be high because you're doing this breathing for about an hour And you're experiencing these releases and your whole body is tingling. And I'm seeing all these images and stuff, and it's so empowering. But I've done it twice with her, and I've always been a little bit scared before I start that it's going to bring something up for me that I don't want to remember. Because when I had my car crash when I was 11, I don't remember any of what happened afterwards, but I know I was awake and it's been locked away. So I've always been scared of accessing stuff that I don't want to see. But what actually happens is very positive. Well, both times I've done this with Sue, this track kicks in. And it's absolutely electric. And it's like this chanting, oh, yeah, yeah, like that is better than that. And then this beat underneath. And it's so loud. And the room's almost shaking. And you're doing this breathing. And just, I have these, it sounds very woo-woo, but it's not. It's like these really positive visual experiences when I'm doing it. And Sue said to me, I've been to two where that track's kicked in, and she said, every time that comes on, I look at you, and your whole face and your whole body lights up and you start smiling. And like tears can be streaming down my face because you do a lot of emotional release. But oh my God, so I'm thinking track, when I'm trying to get off the island, is my ego track. This will get me out.
Brilliant.
This will get me out. So I will have to share the music somewhere, maybe in a playlist or something.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Another ego track that is going to get me off the island. See, I'm already planning my get out. You're enjoying yourself. I'm like, how do we get off?
Are you allowed to? You're not going to get off.
Well, I bloody am. I'm going to make a boat and I'm going to have a ball called Wilson. And is Slave to the Rhythm by Grace Jones. I love that song so much. It sort of, it hooks into my soul, it feels. And I remember creating a playlist because I can be a little apprehensive when I fly. It's not the flying, it's the fact I can't get off. That's my issue. And we flew to New York and I actually really enjoyed the flight and watched all the films, and we could have stayed on another 4 hours because I wanted to watch a different film. And as we flew in, I'd got this playlist created and Slave to the Rhythm was on, and we flew in and you can see the skyline, and I just again felt so full of joy and passion and power. And so I think that for me is going to be a good song to motivate me to get off the island.
So brilliant.
And also I would dance to it, and she's just, I just love Grace Jones. She's such a badass.
She is iconic.
She's iconic.
Really?
She's such a badass.
Yeah.
And then I thought about because I know that I'm going to need a self-indulgent cry when I'm on the island at some point, just to express and let stuff out. I had so many songs to choose from. I had This Woman's Work by Kate Bush, instantly makes me cry, just so beautiful. Hoppy Polla by Sigur Rós, which was out the year I was pregnant with my daughter, which is just instrumental. And every time I hear it, I start crying in the first two strings. I thought, that's too emotional. It's going to make me think of my family too much and I need my drive and determination.
Yeah.
And Hurt by Johnny Cash. Amazing.
Oh, gosh, that song.
If ever I have to film something where I cry, I listen to any of those and I'm instantly in the right space. But what I actually went for was Lilac Wine by Nina Simone. I just find it so beautiful and it's such a performative song. So I can picture myself strutting around the island, performing it, Lilac Wine, amusing myself. Yeah. And then also it's not too much of a connection to anyone that it will upset me, but I can sort of cry to it without making me feel desperately sad that I'm so far from my family. Oh God, this is so, so telling, isn't it?
You've taken the desert island disc concept to a whole literal level that I've never... I mean, I always listen to the programme going, yeah, God, I don't want to be stuck on a desert island. But it is just an idea for a programme. Whereas you're like...
Method.
Right, I'm going there and I want to get off. It's absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. You should actually be on The Real One because your attitude to it is different to every single other of the thousands of people who've ever been on that programme have never looked at it in the same way as you. I think I'm going to contact Lauren Laverne and be like, you need to get Dame Esther Stamford on now.
I mean, I think I've gone too method. I've taken it all too literally. My last song is I think it, this could possibly be one of my favorite. I think I don't think it's my favorite song. Well, maybe it is, but it's Let's Dance by David Bowie.
Oh, David.
I just love that song. And as soon as it kicks in, dun, dun, at the beginning, and it reminds me of being a child in the 80s, my mum taking me to the park and I'd be in like a little summer dress that was elasticated at the top. Do you remember those?
Oh yes,
and then
I love them.
Going down the slide and ripping it, but it's the smell of summer as a child, and and the slide feeling huge. But I just also, my whole family, we all love David Bowie, and I can just dance around the island to it, so that would be my fifth song. But I have taken it too literally. I think it tells me a lot about myself.
I love it. I just think it's so fascinating. Thank you. And what's your luxury item?
My luxury item is a pen and paper, but unlimited amounts of pens and paper so that I can write.
Yeah, you could write the complete works of Esther Stanton. Well, you wouldn't have time though, because you'd probably be drawing diagrams of how to get off the island. All right, so you've got the complete, you've got your pen and paper, unlimited supply of pen and paper. You've got the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, who doesn't go anywhere?
Exactly.
If that made sense. And what would your other book be?
I had written something down, which I will say, but actually I might go for something else. So I'd written, I'll take the scripts of Victoria Wood just to amuse myself so I can read them through, which is good. But actually, thinking that I've got the Queen of Complete Works of Shakespeare, I might take Miriam Margolyes' autobiography because I love her. And I could reread that over and over again.
Yeah. That's very
good.
Well, maybe I could hop onto your. I mean, if we could share, you know, if it could be neighbouring desert islands.
Oh, that would be nice.
We could be. We could do a little play.
We could. We could get some tin cans and talk to each other from island
to
island.
Absolutely, we could hold up signs.
Alas,
stick
poor
bits of paper
Yorick.
We interrupt this programme with a Yobash. Studies have shown that listening to classical music can help you become significantly more intelligent, while listening to the podcast Limited Time Only can help you to become significantly sillier. Both qualities worth pursuing. Goodbye.
Dame Susie of the Archer's fame and Oscar winner and the top podcast in the world, Limited Time Only. Do you like my Kirsty Young? It's not brilliant, Kirsty Young, but it's,
I should have done Lauren Laverne, shouldn't I?
Yes.
Actually, that was quite good.
Yeah. That was quite good. Oh, do you ever listen to the old ones, though? And
I do.
Sue Lawley. And Sue Lawley is bloody terrifying.
Is she?
She's absolutely terrifying, so I'm not going to do Sue Lawley. Anyway, Kirsty Young. Tell me what your first track is, Suze.
Well, so I was just listening to this before we came on air. Pretend it's live. And I made myself cry.
So
I've got five tracks. I had the kind of opposite attitude to this to you, Esther. And it was such a marked attitude, because it's not like me. I'm normally kind of like poring over something and I'm not sure. Will they like that? Will they not like that? But I was like, do you know what? There is an endless amount of songs that I could pick for this. And also we've cut it down from 10 to 5, so we've just got it. I was like, I've got to be disciplined. And I almost went with the first song that came to my mind, songs that came to my mind. Or at least I went for the best of three. Like I'd pick a part of my life or a story, and then I'd go, oh, it could be that one, or that. Right, go for that
Brilliant.
One.
Brilliant, very instinctive.
So, and in fact, actually, the first two choices I've got, it was the best of three. And then the last three were just, I just did it. Because I was like, there's so many. But that's what's so brilliant about this programme, I think, because it's just endlessly possible. But all the ones you pick will be just as good as the ones you don't.
Yes.
And
yes.
Vice versa. My first one, I thought, right, I'm going to go right back to my childhood. And I picked a song that really reminds me of being in a car with my mum, driving along. Because obviously when you're a child, your musical, what you hear is completely influenced by your parents.
Yes, it is.
You just listen to what they're listening to. Although, actually, I don't know if that's as true these days, because I think I only really watched CBeebies and listened to kind of nursery rhyme CDs for the first sort of 5 years of my kids' life. So maybe that's switched round now. But when I was little, we were listening to John Denver. My mum really, big into kind of like country sound, I think. But she liked John Denver, the Hollies, just kind of harmony, gentle stuff, really. But we listened to a lot of Jim Croce. I was also kind of fascinated because Jim Croce was dead by the time I was listening to his music. And I thought it was quite weird.
Who is Jim Croce? I've never heard of him.
Jim Croce is an American kind of country singer, I suppose. He's got an absolutely beautiful, beautiful voice. Yeah, he released 5 albums between 1966 and 73. He was born in 1943 and died in 1973.
Oh, wow, only 30. Well, it can.
I suppose it can.
People can die at 30.
He looks a lot older than 30.
Oh, does he? Does he? What was one of his songs?
So the song I've picked is called Time in a Bottle.
Okay.
I can sing a little bit for you.
Go on then, Suze.
Because I don't think anyone's going to know it. Well, they might do. It's quite sad, really. If I could save time in a bottle.
Oh, I do know this.
The first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away just to spend it with you.
Are you crying?
I'm crying. But then what made me laugh was that the chorus goes, but there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. And I was like, oh my goodness, it's about limited time. So in fact, it's kind of our, it's like our song, really. It's Limited Time Only podcast song.
Well, let's call it Mr. Crochet's Men and see if we can get it on.
But it really reminds me of being a child, sitting in the car, and it reminds me of my mum, and I think, oh crikey, it's going to be one of those songs, isn't it?
Yeah.
Eventually. But it's a beautiful, beautiful song. He's got such a gorgeous voice, and I like music that you can sing to and or dance to. I don't normally pick. I'm not a very slow song kind of person.
No.
And actually, I suppose it's not that slow, but it is kind of melancholy and gentle, whereas I'm kind of more of a bang it out kind of a person.
As you say to your husband.
Bang it out! Get on with it! It's nostalgic. It's a beautiful tune, and it kind of holds a lot of meaning. And when I was a child listening to it, of course, those lyrics didn't really mean as much as they do now that I'm older. I actually probably thought it was quite dull.
Yes, probably.
As a kid. But there was other. Like, he's got this brilliant song called "Bad Bad Leroy Brown."
Oh yes,
we loved that. Because that's just like a great story about this character. Baddest man in the whole damn town. And we thought that was great. But that's my first.
Lovely choice.
Disc.
I shall dig that out.
Okay, the second one refers to the sort of next period of my life when I was in the Central Junior Television Workshop and discovering what it was that really made me tick as a person, which is, of course, performing and being in a company of people, I think, as well. And school and all those things. And I went, I was like, am I going to pick a Cypress Hill song? Am I going to pick Criss Cross and Make You Jump, Jump? I mean, all these things went through my mind. But in the end, I've settled on Lean On Me.
Oh.
When you're not strong, I'll be your friend.
Be your friend.
Nice. Get the harmonies in. Because it really sums up Workshop for me. Because we always used to sing it.
Yeah,
well.
We did.
And we still sing it now. And it just, if I hear that song, I just instantly think of all my Workshop friends probably sitting on a coach singing it, going somewhere.
Do you know what the one I think of from Workshop days is? Under the Bridge, and us all singing that on a coach and everybody getting off with each other. Like, everybody snogging each other.
I definitely wasn't getting off with people.
Oh, I was. I was always snogging. Usually Graham.
No.
I was usually snogging Graham, to be honest.
Oh, well, you know. Somebody had to. lucky girl.
I think a lot of people did.
I know. oh, hello, Graham.
He was quite the boy.
He's quite the boy. And I thought, actually, that's just a lovely song in terms of friendship. And it means a lot in terms of not just Workshop friends, but also school. And just having those. And also that thread of having the friends that stay with you through the whole of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's my second
disc. I love it.
My third disc, This is another kind of melancholy one, but also is quite hopeful. But for me, it sums up my kind of obsession with Britpop, my love of all things melodic, I suppose, and also my love of Damon Albarn, because it's This Is a Low by Blur, which is such a beautiful song. I'm going to sing it again. I'm going to sing it because otherwise. This is a low, but it won't hurt you. You know that one?
Yes, that's lovely.
It's such a lovely song.
The lyrics
song.
Are beautiful.
Yeah, and I think it's brilliant to sing to. It hits the time, that time period for me, which I just absolutely adored, that period of the 90s where, you know, you are becoming an adult and the discoveries that you're making about you as a person. And I loved Blur. It reminds me of university, which was a great time in my life. And yeah, the lyrics, this is a low, but it won't hurt you. And I've just heard Blur talking quite a lot recently because they had that their reunion concert. And I heard Graham Coxon and Damon Albarn talking about how we're all so keen to, when we feel low or sad or depressed, probably not in a clinical way, but we're all keen to kind of, right, how can we fix this? How can we fix this? But actually, those periods are essential for us to grow, and also artistically and creatively you need those periods to be able to create, really.
Absolutely. You need to, it's something that took me a long time to learn. It's best to sit with the feelings and let them go through you and do what they need to do and then move on. But I think it's hard when you're younger. I sometimes say it to my daughter, you know, if she's feeling anxious about something, this isn't going to hurt you. It feels like it's the end of the world, or it feels like it's going to hurt you, but it won't actually hurt you. It's just something that needs to, you need to let it wash over. You need to sit with it. Yeah. Don't distract, keep distracting yourself from it. And that's lovely lyrics. It's not a song of Blur's that I know particularly well, but I shall revisit it.
It just really encapsulates that idea, doesn't it?
And
I thought that's really interesting, actually. They're in their 50s now, but in their 20s they were conscious of that. And I think that just kind of a reflection of what an intelligent band they are.
Yes.
I mean, I just love Blur, basically.
How amazing Damon Albarn is.
Can you please come on
the podcast? Be your husband.
He should. I've touched his naked chest.
I know you have. I mean, I'm very disappointed he didn't lick his nipple as he went over above your head.
I'm not that tall. So anyway, that was my third track.
The lyrics to This Is a Low reference BBC Radio 4's The Shipping Forecast, itself a radio classic. Probably should have mentioned that, Mum?
My fourth, I don't know if this is a bit of cheating. Am I allowed an entire classical works? Because I am going to pick Mozart's Requiem. It's the absolute banger of classical music. Guys, if you haven't listened to Mozart's get it. Download it now. It is mind-blowingly brilliant. I would sing this in a concert. If I was booked to sing this in a choir, not a soloist, in a concert every month, I would do it because it's so good. It's dramatic. It's exciting. It's scary.
I love the scary voice.
It's short.
It's short.
The violins go absolutely bonkers. I mean, if I had to pick one track from it, it would be Dies Irae, which is terrifying. And it's got drums and violins that go really, really fast. Dies Irae, Dies Irae, Dies Irae, if I will attest it, I come sibilla.
You went so childlike when you were describing that. You obviously love it. I will listen to it.
It's so good. And there's a brilliant film called Amadeus.
Yes.
Peter Shaffer. It's a play as well. But it's a fantastic film which is about the writing of Mozart's Requiem. I mean, it's fictionalized. But this rivalry between Salieri and Mozart, and who Salieri perceived as this young upstart, but obviously Mozart's an absolute musical genius, but it's a brilliant brilliant play, and then you get a real sense of how fantastic Mozart's Requiem as well. So that's my fourth. Oh, also because I've sung it a lot of times, and it's so much fun to sing. It's just really exciting. And I sang it, the last time I sang it, I was pregnant. Actually, no, the time before, penultimate time I sang it, I was pregnant with my daughter. And it was in the Albert Hall. And I was like, this is great. She is experiencing Mozart's Requiem in utero.
Wow, that's very cool. That's very cool.
Ah, yes. I'm a complete and utter geek, and that's just confirmed it for everybody listening. So, because what's joyful about this is that I've picked a real banger of a classical piece, and now I'm moving on to an absolute banger of a folk piece. So my fifth and final...
Absolute banger!
Absolute bangers! I'm such a gimp, but I love it so much. So my fifth and final piece is by Bellowhead, my favourite folk band, who are an 11-piece folk band comprising of wind, string, accordion, there's drums. It's so... they're amazing live. They've won Best Live Band at the BBC Two Folk Awards multiple times, and I saw them last year at the Albert Hall, and they're absolutely incredible. And I'm going to pick track number 3 from their reassembled live album, which is called Parson's Nose, and it's an instrumental piece, but it's just, you just want to dance, and my kids love it. It's their favourite track on the album as well, and you just want to dance, and that's what folk music is, really. It's dance music.
Yeah.
And it's the same with classical. You know, no other music would exist without this music.
Yeah.
And it's there to make us move. That's what's it for? What is music for? I mean, multiple things, but ultimately we want to move to it. And when I listen to Bellowhead's music, I just want to dance. I want to move. And I love this one because it is I love their pieces with singing as well, but the fact this is just instrumental, and it is honestly, it's a banger. So so that's my, and I, yeah, and I just folk music, I think I sort of found my niche in a way with folk, and I'm learning the fiddle,
Fiddler on the Roof,
and I love the stories that are entwined within folk music. And also I think it kind of links to the Archers as well. I think the Archers has a folk link, you know, set in the countryside, and there was folk music within the Archers early on, and the theme tune obviously as well. And Bellowhead have adapted the theme tune for that's the music you hear the omnibus on a Sunday, is the Bellowhead version of the Barrack Green Archers theme tune. So there's lots of links there, and yes, I'm speaking very quickly now to try and finish it off, but there you are. That's my five pieces, because I could talk about it forever. My five pieces that I just picked very quickly, because they just came bam into my head. So I've got a luxury item.
Oh, yes, yes. What's your luxury item?
Well, I didn't have to think too hard about this either. I was like, well, what, you know, you're stuck on a desert island. You want something to do, don't you? So my luxury item is going to be my fiddle.
Oh, yes.
Because then I can just get really good at it.
Yeah.
And it would be endlessly interesting. And then I could sing along to stuff. And then, I mean, I get my complete works of Shakespeare.
Yes, of course. And what else? What book would you take?
What book would I take? I'd probably want to take the Wolf Hall trilogy or something. Yeah, maybe that, because it's historical and interesting and good.
Fabulous. And Susie, if you could just choose one of those five tracks, what would you take?
Mozart's Wreck.
Oh, well, Mozart's Wreck. I can see your body popping around the island with your fiddle to Mozart's Wreck.
Oh, good Lord. Absolute. I'm off. I'm going there now.
Video killed the radio star. I think of myself as a patron of the arts. I buy theatre tickets. Encore. I attend cinematic presentations.
Can I see some ID, madam? This is a 12 certification.
Oh, blast. And I adore a good art exhibition. Who's this by? It's just blobs.
Picasso?
Oh. But it's only now that I can call myself a true patron, as I've become a patron of Limited Time Only podcast. My support enables Susie and Esther to make LTO the best it can be, and gets me bonus content and experiences I don't want to miss. I've just signed up for the patron-only LTO Live Online. To sign up, go to patreon.com and search for Limited Time Only Podcast. There's a link in the show notes and in the LTO Instagram bio. I'll see you over there. I'm just off to the opera. Toodaloo! Please do not adjust your dial.
To Hello Marconi House, London calling. To Hello Marconi House, London calling.
Aimez-vous le hip-hop? Écoute ça!
Of course, there is no solid evidence that Vikings wore undergarments at all.
Time to reveal this week's number one. For the 16th week in a row, it's Bryan Adams's Everything I Do It For You.
Oh, I do love you, Geoffrey. I love you most dreadfully.
That's wonderful, Marion. Now, where's my dinner?
The slow motion replay doesn't show how fast the ball was really travelling. Janet from Moseley, are you ready to play Ted's Test with me, Ted Frames?
Yes, Ted.
To win a signed photo of me, who is my favourite DJ?
Tony Blackburn.
No, Janet. It's me, Ted Frames.
Now on Classic Chill Out, it's the Cacophony Ensemble with Fracas for organ.
Bryan escaped from Sue's pocket and was tragically squashed by Sue as she flailed in pain. She never recovered from the loss of her pet ladybird.
Brad, Chelsea, get down here now!
Next tonight, we have Birmingham bass band Japan Thunder Ears in session. Stay tuned.
Oh, and I was saying to Esther, how embarrassing that I was going, Steve, could you record in a quiet room with your head? I was like, my God, DJ legend, and I'm telling him. But I was like, I better keep it in, you know, just in case.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah. It's like when you have to tell people not to swear on air. Like we have to say, and by the way, Suze, it's live if you cannot swear, just in case you've never been on the radio ever before.
Today's guest is radio legend Steve Lamack. Music journalist, broadcaster and renowned DJ, Steve has been one of the main presenters on BBC Radio over the last 30 years. Championing acts like Blur, The Verve and Oasis, Steve Lamack's name is synonymous with Britpop. And his sixth music show, Lamack Live, has been hailed the UK's most influential indie radio show. We talked to Steve about his incredible career, his dreams and ambitions as a young boy, and the moment he heard Elastica for the first time and signed them to his label in a very rock and roll way. Welcome to the show, Steve Lamack.
You've been a news journalist, a music journalist, you've edited a fanzine, you were a pirate radio DJ, you founded a record label, you're a Radio 1 DJ, Radio 6 music DJ, Top of the Pops presenter, you're now chairman of Live as well, you're regularly called a legend, and you're credited with launching Blur's career. I mean, we've got quite a lot to chat about. It's immense.
Hang on. You missed, in my teens, I qualified as a referee, a football referee, and used to referee youth games.
Oh, wow.
On a Sunday afternoon or a Sunday morning.
Have you done it since?
No.
Any plans to go back?
No. I mean, it's quite dispiriting when you're walking off to the, you know, to the booze of under 12 dads. Going, oh, there's never a corner ref.
Under 12 dads are very competitive as well, aren't
they?
Oh,
they are. Yeah, they really are. I mean, it was, you know, it was quite good fun. About four or five of us all qualified at the same time. I did get to run the line. I was a linesman at a cup final at Sudbury Towns Ground, which, I mean, at that point, you know, it was our local equivalent of being at Wembley or something.
Did you have desire to go into football initially? Was that what it was you were going to do?
No, I think I should explain that I grew up in a tiny village in Essex, in northeast Essex. It's about 10 miles from Colchester. It was about 4 miles away from school in Halstead, and it has two buses a week, one in and one out. And at the last census, the population was 1,003. So there's not a lot of jobs, part-time jobs around. Eventually, I did the Sunday paper round. But actually, we worked out that there was a shortage of referees, and you could get paid a few bob and, you know, keep fit and run around, and so that's why we did it, really. More than a driving ambition to get involved in football, it was a way of being able to claim some petrol money so
you could get out
Saturday. Yeah, you could go and buy some records.
Actually get out and leave. So what was the first pull to music? Do you remember your first sort of record that you bought?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's strange. It's so end of 1973, 74. And I don't know why, really. I mean, again, my parents aren't really into pop music. My dad is a massive fan of trad jazz, which is the music he grew up with, skiffle and trad jazz. So when I was, you know, 8 or 9 years old, my dad probably had 100 records, of which 97 of them were trad jazz records, and 50 of those were by Chris Barber and these jazz and blues men. So I didn't really, and being an only child as well, I had no one really to tell me about pop music. So I sort of fell in love with pop music on my own. But my folks, for some reason, they started listening to, or we would have on while we're having tea on a Sunday. We listened to the Top 20 on Radio 1, which was presented by a guy called Tom Brown. And, and the music at the time, obviously, was you know, was really good. I mean, I look back now, and in the week I bought my first single, I could have bought records by The Faces, I think possibly Roxy Music, definitely David Bowie, I think Mott the Hoople. And yet my entry into pop music was purchasing the number one single of the time at the start of 1974, which was Tiger Feet by Mudd.
Classic. Absolute classic.
Great record.
It is
still a great
record. Yeah, it
great
is a
dance.
Great record. Yeah.
You decided to study journalism.
Yeah, I mean, so this is how it went. Around about the age of 10, I mean, it sounds ludicrous now when I tell people, but around about the age of 10, and again, you know, there's not much to do in the summer holidays. There's not many kids in the village or anything. And by this point, having discovered music, age 9, I used to listen to Radio 1 all the time during the summer holidays. I used to religiously listen to those old Radio 1 road shows and play, you know, whatever it was called, Bits and Pieces and all that stuff. And I decided this is what I'm going to do when I grow up. I'm going to be a DJ. But you get to a point. Well, firstly, pop music went a bit sour in around about late 75, 76. It wasn't very good, the pop music at the time, I didn't think, and I sort of drifted away from it a little bit. But you start thinking to yourself, well, these people are from another planet. You know, these people, these glamorous, you know, DJs with their rock and roll lifestyles. There is no way that someone in a tiny little village like myself is ever going to, ever going to be broadcasting on the BBC. But my obsession with music returned when I went to big school and started doing homework in my bedroom. And again, you know, you have the radio on. And I started listening to the chart, and all these weird records were popping up by these bands like The Stranglers and the Tom Robinson Band. And the one that changed things for me, I think, was Do Anything You Want to Do by Eddie and the Hot Rods. And I think it was that point where I did think, you know, I'm not going to grow up and work for the local council. I'm going to do something different. And I didn't really know what it was. But I was, music meant so much. It was such a big part of my life. I thought, I really want to do something. So that's when I started a fanzine, because I thought, well, I'll start writing about music.
So how old were you at that point?
So lower sixth,
wow.
I suppose. Yeah, 16, 17, I think, when I started it. Probably 17, actually.
Why did you call it A Pack of Lies?
Why did I call it A Pack of Lies?
Yeah.
Well, I know, again, this is going to sound ridiculous, but the reason for calling it A Pack of Lies was that I could claim justification in court if anyone sued me. So just say, well,
there's the brains.
That is so clever.
Yeah, I was a journalist at a very young age.
Did you used to do Did you used to pretend to be a DJ in your bed? I mean, I know I did.
Yeah.
Stand there, you know, with my cassette recorder, pressing play and record and recording myself.
Oh, I didn't record myself, but I did do the... Oh, yeah, I used to do an alternative chart show every Sunday night at 7. So you'd have your tea, go upstairs, 7 o'clock. I'd be about 13, 14 at the time. And, yeah, I had a record player and a cassette deck and would flip from one to the other. I wasn't as enthusiastic about this, though, as Bob from Franz Ferdinand came in. It was one of the very early Franz Ferdinand interviews. And he said he used to do this, but he used to do it with his sister. But they'd involve other members of the family. So they'd be doing the radio show. That was, you know, the Beatles. And now here's Mum with the Travel.
That's adorable.
Mumming to do the Travel.
That's so cute. Yeah. So how come you didn't feel a pull to be a musician? You felt a pull to be a DJ?
Do you know what? I think it was... There's various things I've worked out over the years. And one is, I think, a very early understanding that for a lot of... I don't think I had the creative drive or the temperament. I don't think I would have been able to deal with the crushing disappointment of nearly making it and then not making it. And on top of that, I've got absolutely no sense of rhythm. So I just couldn't put over it. And also, we really didn't have much chance. You know, these days, like my daughter's learning guitar now. But we never had proper music lessons at school. We'd have music, you know, we'd do music. But I don't think there was even a guitar in the school, in the whole school when we went to big school. Maybe there were two. I think having leafed through the pages of Record Mirror and Sounds and Smash Hits, I think I also felt like you don't look like a pop star or behave like a pop star or have the drive to be a person in a band. So... I was quite, I mean, more than happy just to write about it and be the person who was interested. Because I think that was the thing. You'd read these interviews with bands. I was fascinated by some of these characters. So that was enough being on this side, really.
You're kind of the support for musicians, because without you, it wouldn't, a lot of it, you know, wouldn't happen. It needs to be created into a culture, and without the music journalists and the interest and the getting out there.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, I mean, I used to buy magazines, I used to get Q magazine all the time. I wish I'd kept them actually.
I had
stacks of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of journalism now, is there still that interest in print journalism for music and the, you know, all the little fanzines and things? When I was at university, used to be loads of books of gigs and interviews of people with, you know, fringe bands. Is that still there?
It's not really. I think it's a real shame. I think because I think one of the things that the music papers did do, which I think we miss now, I mean, some of the musicians won't miss this, but actually being properly taken to task, being asked, you know, very serious questions about why you're doing it and what is this about, what do you stand for, and being able to properly critique records. I mean, I was going through some old copies of the New Musical Express the other day, which during my tenure there between 87 and 92, and I came across some of my reviews, and they're absolutely scathing, some of them. I mean, some of the writing is quite brutal, really, and you don't find that. And I'm not saying, you know, I miss people just slagging people off for the sake of it, because obviously that was never a good thing. But I think there is a point where you do want proper critics to be able to pull bands up, however, you know, however big or small they are, and just say, this is a good record and this is a bad record, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, what you're saying is quite right, Susie. It's about contextualizing. It's about taking the muddle of all the music that's out there, and trying to help people make sense of it by making sense of it yourself. And this is, I mean, this is why we created so many scenes at the NME, I think, partly was to say, well, these bands fit here, these bands fit here. If you like this, you'll probably like this. This is, this sort of thing is going on now. So yeah, it's about trying to make sense of stuff. And you know, for a while before there was music everywhere, you felt the responsibility of trying to really communicate what the artists that you liked were about and what they meant to you. And I don't think there's a lot of that writing around at the moment. And if it is, it's probably somewhere on the internet, you know, being poured over by, you know, 1,000 really avid music fans, but it's not there in the centre as it usually used to be. And I mean, the next thing was, so I didn't go to university, but the thing about the fanzine was, I like writing. What am I going to do? What's a job that involves writing? Journalism. Well, I'll take a course in journalism. It was only at the end of that 1 year course in journalism that I suddenly realised I was only now qualified to become a journalist. And that's how I ended up on the West Essex Gazette and later the Harlow Gazette. Well, the West Essex Gazette, the Redbridge Guardian, and then the Harlow Gazette. I think that was my career path.
Illustrious.
And how did you then end up at the NME? What was the journey there?
So I think my editor at the Harlow Gazette works out I wasn't very good at doing hard news, moved me to the sports desk, and I ended up being sports editor at the Harlow Gazette, I mean, sounds like a big gig, but what it means is commissioning photographers to take lots of photos of swimming galas and going to report on Bishop Stortford and Harlow Town on Saturday afternoon.
You couldn't use your refereeing skills then? Is that why you got the
job?
No,
I mean, you know, obviously gave me an insight into how, you know, sympathy for the man in black. So when I became sports editor, obviously I had to learn how to be a sub editor as well. So learning how to lay out pages and write headlines and things. And then the NME had an ad. There was an advert in the NME saying sub editor required. So I sent in a job application, had an interview, and they gave us, you know, 3 months probation, and yeah, never left.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fabulous.
And how, because I was listening to, obviously I've listened to you for years, obviously, but listening to the podcast that you did with Joe Wiley recently, The Rise and Fall of Britpop, and talking about how it was, and because of course with the internet, everything's vastly changed, but how was it that, was it, you know, that kind of a bit of a rock star lifestyle for you as well, or was it just on the fringes there? Did you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could make it as rock star as you wanted. I didn't really like getting too close to bands. And I mean, you know, we used to go out a lot. When I started at the NME, we were in High Holborn, but then we moved down to Blackfriars. But you would roll into, I mean, it's amazing. Start time at the NME, I think, was 10:30. Or 10 o'clock.
It's like radio drama, very civilised.
We'd roll in and, you know, do a few hours work, and then probably be in the pub about 12:30 and then roll back about, you know, just after 2, and then leave at 5:30.
This sounds glorious.
Go to a gig. I'm not going to lie. And then there were times where you were so busy working that you couldn't, you know, you were just stuck at home or in the writing room at the NME, just bashing out features or reviews. I think, there was a lot of hard work involved. But yeah, I mean, the first time I sat on a band's tour bus, it was just, look, I'm on a band's tour bus. It was the Godfathers band called the Godfathers, who I really liked. I'm being paid to sit on the Godfather's tour bus and talk to them. This is amazing. My third day. So bear in mind, obviously, I've come from the sticks, where mostly, you know, I'd say I'd be writing football reports or interviewing the chairman of the local bowls club or something. And then 3 days into my life at the NME, I went to the gents and I was standing 3 urinals away from Marquis Smith from the fall. It's like, wow. My life has changed.
Yeah, it's a bit different from swimming galas.
Do you get did you get starstruck? Or was, I mean, because obviously, I don't know, you sound like you were prepared and you just thought it was really cool. But did you ever have moments where you're like, I don't know what to say. I can't speak.
Yeah, very much. I was a really big fan of Kirsty MacColl from that first single onwards, They Don't Know. And Kirsty came back with an album called Kite, which I think was a real turning point for her. It was a real... I'm not saying it was the first time she'd made a properly good body of work as an album, but it was just... It was a great record. And so I ended up... I think writing about the one of the singles from it, and then the album was coming out, and somebody at Virgin Records said, if we can get a feature commissioned, would you do an interview with Kirsty? And I said, yeah, absolutely I would. And usually, you know, these things are done in pubs, or you go to the management office or something and they sit you in a room. But I'd never had the glamour of, it's all sorted, so it's 1 o'clock at this posh restaurant in the Portobello Road. And so I turn up and there's the press officer and Kirsty MacColl, and I sit down and pleasantries exchange. And then the press officer said, right, I'll leave you to it. And all of a sudden, I'm having lunch with Kirsty MacColl, and who, I mean, this album, I mean, if you go back and listen to it now, it's still relevant. It was so far, part of its observations on things like celebrity and the media, I mean, were way ahead of their time, I think. And I thought she was so brilliant. But here, you want to be a professional New Musical Express journalist. What you don't want to be is entirely gushy. And I'm really trying to hold back on just basically just repeating over and over again. I think it's a really good record. I think it's a really good record. I think you're really great. It's a really great record.
I love you.
You pass the ketchup.
Yeah, and eating as well.
I know.
I mean, did you eat it? I can't, I don't know. I'd be so paranoid that it was just going to go everywhere.
Barely ate anything.
And so from the NME, I know earlier you talked about the fact that there's not enough critical writing, and also you can champion new bands that you believe in. Is that why you started Deceptive Records, your record label, to champion new bands that you could see potential in?
Yes, that was one of the reasons. Throughout my 5 years at the NME, I'd been quite critical of a lot of the major labels because I didn't think they did a very good job, or they didn't really understand pop music, or they wasted a lot of money, or they signed the wrong bands. How they marketed groups, I thought, was slightly offensive at times. And having done that, I suppose that once you've done that for a long time, if you really mean it, then you just have to try and prove that you're right and they're wrong. I think that was the thing. However badly, well or badly it goes, I think, you know, if you're gonna criticize people, you have to do something about it. So that was one of the reasons. When I went to the Harlow Gazette, I moved to Bishop Stortford. But I hung out in a venue called The Square, which was the venue in Harlow, brilliant venue in Harlow. And we always used to have these conversations that the last band to have a top 40 hit who came from Harlow were Roman Holiday. Now, not a lot of people will remember Roman Holiday and their chunky white sweaters, but Roman Holiday in the 80s had a top 40 hit, and there was nothing since. So we started with £3,000 in the bank and a desire to get a band from Harlow into the top 40, and anything else, you know, we didn't really have any ambitions, really. We only developed ambitions when we signed Elastica.
And what was it that you saw in Elastica? When did you see them performing and you saw potential in them?
I heard a demo, actually. A friend of mine, Mike Smith, works at EMI Publishing, and I'd heard about this band, Elastica, And so I got a copy of the demo, and the demo was terrific. I mean, there was four songs and it was all over in about 9 minutes, I think. But it reminds me of all those brilliant new wave records that I really loved. I mean, something like Vaseline, which was one of the early demos, just that it made me think of Denis era Blondie. And anyway, so I went to see them. I saw them at the Camden Falcon in Royal College Street, which is just one tiny back room behind a pub. And I mean, I say I saw them, I could only, it was so full, I could only see two of them. But it was brilliant. It was so thrilling. It was absolutely, it was so exhilarating. It was so natural and raw, and you know, the songs were great, and it just made you feel like you didn't have a care in the world, really. Just one of those gigs where you just, you know, you walk home on such a high, and already humming some of the songs. They were just brilliant, obviously. And then, you know, you get to meet them. I mean, they all looked like, I said this before, but they were basically Britpop's version of the Bash Street Kids, really. I mean, they looked, there was no way they'd sort of been styled, even though they'd obviously decided this is how we're going to look. Because this is how we do look. We shop in charity shops. We look like this, slightly unkempt, like we've just fallen out of bed, but with some sort of... And then how do you make that effortlessly cool, which is what they pulled off? You know, we just grabbed this off the floor where we threw it when we went to bed last night, walked to the photo shoot, and we look amazing. And I think... Yeah. There was so many things about them. They were lovely, lovely people. We signed. I think we did the agreement, I think, in the Good Mixer in Camden for two singles. And then by the time we had to, you know, do a proper record deal, they had a manager and we had to get a proper contract together. But I think the first, I don't know, it was pretty much on the back of a beer mat in a pub in Camden.
That in so itself cool. is very cool.
It's just
yeah.
so cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's another time. When did you move over to Radio 1? Was that during that time?
So, yeah, so I walked out of the Enemy in a fit of pique in October 92. By this point, well, weirdly, I knew a couple of people at Radio 1, including the Radio 1 press officer, who said, by the way, they're starting a new show on Radio 1 and they're going to play all the music, I think, that you write about at the NME. You should get in touch with, they're bringing a producer down from the northeast of England. Why don't you give him a ring or drop him a note? So I did that and went out with this fella. And we had a chat about music, and I said, and we were basically on the same wavelength that, you know, he was saying, I think what we should be playing is Teenage Fan Club and Carter, but we'll also be playing some dance music and this and whatever. And very kindly, when they got up and running on the evening session with Mark Goodyear presenting, they invited us in to do reviews of the music press and roundups of little bands, you know, once a month. And then so this would be start of 93, Mark was away for 4 weeks, so they tried out four new presenters, and I was one of them.
My God, I bet your nine-year-old's head exploded.
Yeah.
nine-year-old Steve.
Yeah. I mean, well, to be honest, they had to obviously explain how the desk worked and everything, because prior to that, all I'd done, I mean, I'd done a couple of years with a pirate station called Q102, which had a mixing desk, you know, with eight maybe faders on it. And you walk into Radio 1 and it's got 30 faders or 32 faders. What do all these things do? Well, those for your carts, you what now? And these the record player, and this is that, and these are your mics, and this is your... but all the time they're explaining this to me, Simon Bates was doing the Golden Hour next door, and it's like, wow. I think me and Joe, I mean, we still talk about it now, but when we first started, we got our first proper contract at the end of 93, and I do think we had a certain amount of imposter syndrome. Obviously Radio 1 changed quite a lot in that first year while we were there, and a lot of the old guard left. But when we first started, it was really strange, you know, sharing the corridors with Bates and Bruno Brooks and people who were, you know, Radio 1 calendar material.
Well, I heard Jo saying that she'd had to, was it the headphone?
Oh, yes, David Lee Travis's
heavily that really smelt of perfume.
Yeah, heavily perfumed headphones.
Were you and Jo kind of thrown together?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know each other before?
We met once on the set of The Word. I think I'd gone to see Mega City 4 play on The Word, and we'd met once there. And yeah, when they put us together, they said, again, you know, you should demo it. So they put us in a studio, and I find it's really hard rehearsing live radio. Because there's no adrenaline for a start. So we sat there for about 20 minutes and then we just vanished. We said, that's probably enough, isn't it? And off we went. So we'd had 20 minutes rehearsal before we went live to air for the first time. Wow. And we learnt on the job, really. But I think we got a letter once, because obviously this is pre-email days. We got a letter once. I think it might have been one of our first ever pieces of fan mail, which said, I love the show, particularly the bits where you get stuff wrong. Do you rehearse them?
How cool. And so you did quite a lot of work with John Peel as well. Was he kind of a mentor to you?
Yeah, we had a strange relationship, me and Peel, because there was, because, you know, Peel was very much, you know, he was such a godfather sort of figure, I guess, to alternative music at that point. And, you know, we were all the young pretenders, really, but we did, but it was always really nice. We used to, you know, occasionally swap records. This one's probably more for you, and this one's probably more, you know, your sort of thing. And we did quite a lot of stuff together at Radio 1 live events. It was a tradition that at least one night, if you were doing something like Sound City where you were away for four nights, at least one of those nights you had to persuade John to stay up in the bar, and then you would buy him a bottle of red wine and just get him to tell you stories and just keep refilling his glass as the stories, you know, just the stories poured out of him. And everyone would gather around, you know, listen to John.
I bet he was fascinating. Actually, we're going to do questions at the end, but it sort of feels like a pertinent time to ask this, which is a question from Howard, who says, how do you think the pirate radio of the 1960s and its top DJs who moved to mainstream media like John Peel, John Walker, Tony Blackburn, etc., influenced the development of music and radio today?
Oh, immeasurably. I think, I mean, the echoes of those days, I mean, just the attitude. I mean, it's strange, really, when I first started at Six Music, and Six Music was a completely new station, just made up of people who had been plucked from various places. And no one was, it wasn't like there was a load of people listening, and, you know, even within the BBC. And it was the closest I'd found my radio experience to be of like being on a pirate. Since I was on a pirate, it was like the Wild West at Six Music. You came up with these ideas, you could do anything. But that was the spirit of the pirates, really. I mean, I always think of Kenny Everett, really, as, you know, being part of that. And if you take some of those people, I mean, you could say that Blackburn was amongst the people who translated that American style of presentation, you know, that fast rolling cut from one record into another record. He helped bring that to Britain, and some of that era DJs helped bring that to Britain. But then, yeah, you've got, I mean, obviously, I think John's style is, you know, was evident and still is slightly today. And also, I think people still want to think that, I mean, I guess Six Music in a way is slightly this, but the ability to be able to play exactly what you want and, you know, just push the music to its, of what's acceptable in radio, kind of to its noisier, more experimental limits. So yeah, definitely in that, in trying to do something, always being on the money, trying to break new ground. Yeah, Peel was important. And yeah, even presenters like, I mean, you know, Johnny Walker was a great DJ, I thought. He was one of my favourite DJs on Radio 1. Because he just seemed so at home in a studio, but also at the same time, you very much got the impression he was just slightly anti-establishment. And I really like that.
And that's kind of what music is, isn't it? It's communicating. It's bringing everybody together. And it's slightly rebellious. So you want something like Six Music. And when it looked like Six Music was going to go a few years ago, I mean, my husband is a massive listener to Six Music and I listen to it. We were really upset because it is this place where you can play everything and anything and hear completely different tracks. And that's so important. So important.
Yeah, I mean, it is. So, you know, with good curation, you know, again, it's about making sense of music, isn't it? You know, if I get, I don't know, in the run up just before I finished my stint on full time Tea Time, we're getting about 40 singles a day, and no one's got time to listen to 40 singles a day, which is why we, you know, try and do it. And then you find the best bits of that. I mean, Peel used to say, when people used to say, how do you do a running order? How do you program a show? And you say, right, one record you know people will like, one record you think they might like, and one record which you don't care whether they like, but you like. And then start again. One record, you know. And that was, yeah. And that's kind of how I've always, you know, looked at radio, really. But so bring people in. Make them feel at home, be as accessible as possible, get as many people around who are interested in music, and then give them something they probably know they like and then something that they didn't know they like or would like, because no one really knows what they're looking for. I mean, you can say, well, you know, if I like Franz Ferdinand, I might like this because it sounds a bit like Franz Ferdinand. But then again, that's fine. But it means you won't get to hear somebody who doesn't sound like Franz Ferdinand, who turns out to be, actually, I don't know, this is brilliant. I mean, I didn't know. One of my bands that I've, you know, recently championed over the, you know, the past few years is a band called Idols. And Idols, if you'd asked me in 2016, what are you looking for? I wouldn't have said, well, 530-somethings from Bristol have been around for ages and a ropey bands that didn't look like it was going nowhere, playing sort of old school punk rock influenced music. That's definitely the thing I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It wasn't, but it turned out it was.
And actually, yeah. Do you know the number of times I've listened to Six Music and we've been driving along and I've gone, what is this song? Quick, I need to, you know, Shazam it or whatever. And I listened to Susie on your show and Bayana by Naya Archives. That's not something I would normally listen to, but I listen to it a lot. I run to it now, but it's not a song I would have ever found or sought out. But I find it so sort of uplifting and energising, and it makes me feel quite, I don't know, brilliant. But it's not a song I would ever have stumbled across if I hadn't have heard it on your show. And that's what's so great. Like you say, you're introducing things to people that they don't necessarily know they even want or like or know even is out there.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's it in a nutshell. Yeah. Yeah.
When you've been, because obviously you've spoken to thousands of musicians on air, live on air. I just wondered what, if you've got moments that stick out as being horribly awkward, like the worst possible moment ever, and the best possibly.
Jay Maskis from Dinosaur Jr. He's not the most gregarious of people. He's not the most chatty of people. Is Jay Maskis? Jay Maskis occasionally, depending on what sort of mood he's in, Beck can be brilliant or slightly ponderous. I mean, I love Damon Albarn to bits, but there are points where that gap between thoughts is almost long enough that the emergency tape will kick in because it thinks it's falling off air. Lovely man.
Do you feel your blood pressure rise? Oh, yeah. God, please say something, David. Yeah. Please speak.
What do you do in the, you know, if someone is so kind of monosyllabic or just doesn't want to be there? What's your strategy?
I always overwrite questions. So if I think I'm going to need, if the time that you've been allotted is probably 10 questions worth, then I'll write 20 questions, then rattle through them, and then we'll get to the ends. Or I'll try and tell a story at some point, which I think is relevant and personal. And occasionally that will, in some difficult interviewees, you know, that will melt the ice. And, you know, that will help. And if it doesn't, I mean, I remember Gary Crowley on BBC London interviewed a band. I won't say which band it is, but they were being particularly just very American and very sort of dismissive. And eventually Gary just stood up and went, I mean, if you're not interested in doing the interview, nor am I. And here's a record.
Brilliant.
And that's it.
Well, it's fair play, isn't it, really?
No, absolutely. I absolutely admire him for it. Because, you know, we always try and show respect to anyone who comes on the show, because if they've given us their time, then at least you should do is listen to the record properly, prep the interview properly, know what you're talking about. So, but we always do a good job, I think. I'd like to think so. And if someone then can't be bothered, I mean, yeah, obviously there'll be, you don't know what's happening in their lives. And occasionally some artists will have an off day. This is more about the bands who professionally hate doing interviews or want to come across in a way which they think is cool, but is actually slightly surly and dull.
Yeah. I'm on the podcast, the Rise and Fall of Britpop, and remembering the Oasis interview, which I remember hearing live and kind of like going, because it was built up for ages, and I was like, so excited, and it was just an absolute listening to you on that is just absolutely fantastic. I mean, I don't know how you held it together.
Nor do I really. I think it's just adrenaline and fear. Probably just kept us going, just determination to get to the end. If people don't know it, there was a lot of swearing in the interview, and it turns out, I didn't realise at the time, it turns out I think they'd had one or two refreshments in the afternoon at an awards ceremony, and then and Liam wanted to get off his chest how displeased he was at being criticised by members of the Rolling Stones. So he called them out for a fight on Primrose Hill. then went on. I mean,
I think the offer's still there.
The language was extreme, I think. And what I remember that night is I finished the show, and I was in a slight state of shock, really. So I went for a drink afterwards. I went to a pub around the corner called the Stag's Head. And Gary, who was the landlord at the time, who I knew, I walked in and he had a pint waiting for us. And he just went, oh, mate. That was it. Oh, mate. And he said they'd had it on in the pub, but he'd had to turn it off after 10 minutes because of all the swearing.
It's too much.
Mate.
It's a classic. It is a classic. Well, as is what I'm going to mention next, because I have to hijack now the interview to talk about the Archers, obviously, and your love of the Archers, which I think is the crossover that no one ever believed would be possible, the Archers and Six Music. And I wondered, where did it start? Where did your... And how long have you been listening?
Well, at various periods. So, I think I'm trying to. I would go back to where we go. Maybe about 20. I don't know. 90. I remember. I certainly remember in 1991 or 92. 91, it would have been actually. No, actually, it's later than this. Hang on a second. When did I comp a Reading Festival from 94 onwards? So about 97. I can work it out because there was a guy called Steve Cheney, and Steve Cheney was the stage manager for the main stage at the Reading Festival. Did it for years, and he was a big guy who had a sense of authority about him. Let's just say, if he said do something, people did it. If he was if there was something that needed to happen, it would happen because Steve said so. It was quite an imposing figure. He was the loveliest man. He was the sweetest guy underneath. But yeah, he was. I don't know. I went up the first year I did Reading. I was slightly scared of him, but it turned out he was, as I say, he was a really lovely guy. Anyway, this scary man who can shout down tour managers of massive American rock bands. This scary man on the Sunday comes over to us and says, "I need a favour from you." And I went, anything, Steve? What is it? In all these BBC trucks, is there anywhere I can get to hear the latest episode of The Archers? The Archers, of course, The Archers. We all used to listen to The Archers, didn't he? I remember that. Yeah, so from then, and then I guess you get out of a routine, and then about 2000 and, what would it be? About 2005, I got back into it. And I've been with the Archers ever since. Yeah.
And what did, I just wonder what the reaction from, you know, Six Music, what the bosses were when you said, "I'd like to do an Archers round table." They're like, "What? Yeah. Sorry, what?"
I think, to be fair to Six Music management, over the years, I think they've come to just appreciate that there maybe is some method in my madness, you know, and that you know, if I think there's something in this, journalistically, if nothing else, then they'll go with it. But yeah. It's just great though, The Archers, isn't it? I mean, whether you listen to the, because I'm more an omnibus kind of person, really, whereas my wife is very much every day there is a point. It's perfect because there's 15 minutes of drama, which is exact, well, 13, whatever it is, 13 minutes, 50 seconds of drama, which is exactly the time you need for that last rush round before you go to work. Or, you know, it's a brilliant period of time, isn't it? Really. And then the debates that you can have about it. You know, that was partly how we got together. Myself and Jen, my wife,
yeah, tell
was
us.
Talking about was I was we were all out. There was two groups of people, and Jen was with somebody I work with, and myself and my friend Neil were standing outside. Neil, who used to book all the bands at the Reading Festival, who's also an Archers fan. In fact, three of the members of our cribbage team are Archers fans.
Good people.
Yeah, all good people. But we just stood outside talking about the Archers, and Jen had come out, and she came over and said, obviously thinking, what are these two, you know, at the time 40 something blokes, they talking about the I came over, are you talking about the Archers? And I said, yeah we are. And then she just started firing questions at us about what we thought about various characters and where the plot line was going at the time. And I was like, man alive, this, hello, can I buy you a drink? And yeah,
I think we might be soulmates.
Yeah, that's it.
It's so brilliant. Well, I've asked, we've asked people for some quick fire questions for you. And I've got quite a few from members of the Archers cast.
Oh, really?
Okay. So I'm going to start with...
Just going back to what you were saying about the nine-year-old me and what I was thinking when I was sat having a meal with Kirsty McColl. You do realise this is the same now, is that members of the Archers cast. I mean, people say, do you get, I don't really get starstruck. I can handle being around musicians. I don't go to pieces if, you know, I bump into, I don't know, I don't want to name drop, but Dave Grohl or, you know, you see, I don't know, Noel Gallagher or something. But I go to absolute bits if I meet any member of the Colchester United first team. I'm completely speechless. I don't know what to say. I just talk gibberish. and now the Archers.
Well, the feeling's mutual. So I'm surprised we've been able to speak. It was just be silence for an hour. But the first question I've got is from my sister, Susan Carter. So she has asked if, I mean, you've probably been asked this well, a few times, so hopefully it won't take you too long to answer. Five musicians, dead or alive, that you'd have around for dinner.
Oh.
Probably quite hard, actually.
Yeah. Right. Oh, crikey. I mean, there's so many, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because you want to have somebody, a mixture of new and old, probably. Rebecca from Self Esteem, I think, would definitely be one. Because she's got that brilliant Sheffield knack of, you know, she's got great stories, talks about things enthusiastically, has a real love of stuff, and it's just, I find she's really interesting and brilliant. And he's not a liar, but Joe Strummer, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think would be interesting. Who else? I guess, well, Richard Butler from the Psychedelic Furs, although he's not very chatty.
Maybe with a few drinks.
Yeah, yeah.
Just line up your questions, it'll be fine.
Yeah. Who else do I like? I like, maybe, I don't know. I'm trying to, you see, now I've got a dinner party. I've got an actual table.
You could have more. Have more.
Captain Sensible. Captain Sensible, maybe. He's always good. He's good.
He'd be good.
Nadine Shah, Joe from Idols. Probably, I mean, there's quite a lot.
Sounds good. It's gonna be. I think that was six.
Yeah, was it? Okay. I don't know what.
We'll get Kirsty MacColl in there as well.
Yeah, Kirsty MacColl. Yeah. So this time I'd be able to actually hold a proper conversation.
Yes. She Charlotte also asks, have you got a favourite David Bowie track?
Sound and Vision, Golden Years.
And Charlotte was and is heavily into punk rock.
Really?
Would you believe it? Susan Carter, punk rock fan.
No way. That's true.
I can't believe it. It's true. Absolutely true. I don't think you've ever had her on the round table. I mean, I have to say, most of the cast are absolutely gutted. They're never going to be able to do it. You have to do it on your Monday show.
Yeah.
Just a special.
Yeah, we will.
But she says, which band for you, or do you think, epitomises the genre best of all? That's hard. Hard question.
I mean, it is. I mean, well, let's take away the Pistols and the Clash and all those. Maybe mm-hmm. X-Ray Specs. I think X-ray Specs, in a way, the way they did it, they came and went in a almost blink of an eye. But yeah, I think they had the DIY spirit. They had obviously polystyrene with a fantastic alternative view. I think everything about them, and the fact that they really couldn't play. You know, that was part of the thing about punk. It doesn't matter whether you can play or not. I think the Adverts or X-Ray Specs, one of those. Again, Adverts couldn't really play. T.V. Smith, though, is still, to me, one of my favourite lyricists of that time. Still is now, actually. He's still playing. But, one of those.
I'll put that to Charlotte and see what she came up with. I've got a question from Maddie Leslie, who plays Chelsea. My daughter, so it's basically a family show. Is there a song or a piece of music that's helped you get through a difficult time in life? Is there a one particular track that you go back to?
Dry Your Eyes by the Streets. I think I was quite down about something at that point. Don't know what. Tender by Blur, I suppose, maybe. I'm trying to think of times where, I mean, the weird thing is, where usually when I'm moping around, rather than listening to sad or inspirational stuff, I just listen to very angry records. So it's an album by a band called The Mice, which is called Scooter, and a sort of a prototype American pop punk record from the end of the 80s, which I listened to over and over again when I split up with my first, you know, that first relationship that lasted, you know, more than a year. When that came to an end, that whole Scooter album, I think, was just furious, and that's how I felt, you know, just didn't know what to do with all my emotions, and it comes out in that record.
Yeah, yeah. And on the flip side, is there a song that just brings you joy, that you
Harry Go Brinkum by Justin Hines. One of the things about listening to the Peel show and also liking The Clash was that I was lucky enough to sort of discover a love of reggae, which then led to Steel Pulse's first album, Handsworth Revolution, which is still today. If you don't like reggae, have a listen to that record. It was absolutely, it was so good at that. It was captured the moment so well. But so I love reggae and ska music, and Carrie Go Brinkum is just, yeah, just from the moment it starts, like you can't stand still, can't be glum when this is going on. So it's
brilliant. Have you got another 5 minutes? We've got some more, couple more questions we want to ask you, but it is 12 o'clock.
No, it's absolutely fine. I've got,
is that okay? Because I don't want it, because I know we have got more from people who've you know, ask questions. I mean, stick with the Archer just quickly. Ronnie Jutty, who plays Ardil, asks, have you got a favourite or most interesting Archer's character?
Oh,
Tracy Horribin, obviously, Steve. I mean, I don't know why you've paused long.
this does sound weird, but Tracy, and particularly over the past year, has been one of the best and most interesting characters. And I guess because Tracy, you can channel a lot of different storylines from the real world through Tracy. And I think that's really interesting. And obviously Tracy is the character who, and sort of inherited this, I suppose, from maybe the Grundys, and that, you know, things quite often don't go right, but you're always willing her to have a better time. Tracy is the person in the Archers who you'd like to win the lottery. I'm not suggesting that as a plot line, by the way, because that would be terrible. But you know,
she'd have to lose it immediately.
Yeah, the local rapper or something. But it's, yeah, I think Tracy. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's something brilliantly reliable about Linda, and the fact that if you took Linda out, so much it's like Archer's Jenga. If you took Linda out, and I know obviously the Archers themselves, you know, you have to hang things around David and Ruth, and similarly if you took them out, but they actually they could go away on holiday if you wanted for a bit. Whereas Linda, I don't know, Linda does so many jobs, and there is nothing better than when Linda obviously comes across quite officiously for 90% of the time, and then there'll be that scene where Linda puts a metaphorical arm around someone, and then, yeah, you know, there are some really touching moments, some real pathos brought to the programme through Linda, I think. So
La Snell, I think you did call her that.
Yeah, La Snell.
Everyone was delighted. Yeah, she's wonderful. And there's just really strong characters, aren't they? They're kind of, and I love that idea of it being a Jenga. And you're so right.
Yeah.
And then when it's, you know, and it does sometimes go, because people, you know, things move on. And it's, and that's what's amazing about it as well. This kind of historical that it's just been going and going and going. And these characters kind of, yeah, grow up with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, we won't get into that, because we'll be here all blooming day. And one more from me, from Nick Barber, who you've had on the round table a couple of times, who plays Rex. And I think I might know the answer to this now from early on in the interview. What awful experience in your past made you take against jazz music so much?
It were one of the Chris Barber gigs that I was dragged along to, probably.
Thought it might have been there.
Yeah, when I was young. I mean, I always say my first gig was a punk band called The Lurkers. And the first one of my choosing was The Lurkers. But there were, several jazz gigs that I would have gone to, which I didn't really understand. I'm not sold on Chris Barber, but I do like things. I've quite taken to Bix Beiderbecke and a couple of other jazz records, which I've got over the last couple of years. So, I mean, once, I mean, is this the first sign that one day I'm going to wake up wearing sandals and loving
jazz FM. Here we come.
That's going to be something of a shocker for the audience of the new show, isn't it? Yes. He seems to be opening the show with Theolonious Monk. Hang on a second. Is that Acker Bilk?
Oh my goodness, Esther, have you?
Yes,
got some,
I've got a few.
Some
of them have been
related.
Answered, so I won't ask all of them because we've kind of answered them through the show. But favourite music venue from Ian?
Oh, at the moment, all the great ones down the years, Fulham Greyhound, Harlow Square, places like that. At the moment, in London, I like the Lexington. Obviously, there's still the Adelphi in Hull, which I've great fondness for, having been there on and off for about 30 something years. The Brudenell in Leeds, the Brudenell Social Club in Leeds, I'd recommend if you're ever in Leeds, just pop in. It's a really friendly place. They've got two venues within one. That's great. There's loads of, but yeah, there's many others. I love Clubby Fall Back in Cardiff. Oh, the Joiners in Southampton. That's a good one. I could go on for ages.
Yeah, brilliant. What was your first concert or gig? Luna asks that.
Yeah, so it was the Lurkers. The Lurkers were a West London punk band who released an album called Fulham Fallout in the summer of 78. And then they had a single out called Ain't Got a Clue, which became my favourite record. And after Mud, they were probably the band that I, you know, obsessed about probably more than any others. And then it turned out in September of 1978, they were going to play the Chancellor Hall in Chelmsford. I was 13 at the time. How I convinced my mum and dad to let me go to the gig, I don't know, but they gave me a lift on a Saturday night to the gig, dropped me off. They went off for a meal. I went to this punk gig. Obviously, I demanded that we've got to be there at 7:30. Because it says on the ticket 7:30 it starts. I've obviously thought it was like a football match that was kickoff time. So I got there at seven thirty with my ticket. It was a tiny queue of Essex punks outside. Walked in. I've got no idea what I did for, you know, until even the support band goes on. Just because I'm on my own and you can't drink or anything. But I think I was just overawed by the whole occasion. And then an Essex punk band called The Sods supported. Halfway through the set, the bassist of The Sods spat on my jacket, hopefully by accident. and then the Lurkers came on, and it was just terrific. And that, I know this again sounds ludicrous, but I think that it changed my life really. After that, all I wanted to do was go to another gig and go to another gig and go to another gig and go to another gig. It was so, so exhilarating. What you don't realise before you actually go to a gig, particularly in those days, I think, was the actual physicality of the music, because it's not just, you know, the fury, the sound, the songs and everything. It's the way you feel it almost coming through the floor. And the actual, because some of their songs were, you know, sounded quite violent. There was this, and then the crowd surging, all these things. There were so many emotions, so much to work out afterwards. And of course, my ears rang for about 3 days. I thought I'd permanently damaged them already, but I couldn't tell my mum and dad for fear that they wouldn't let me go to any other gigs after that. So I suffered in silence. But it was just brilliant. So yeah, Lurkers, Chancellor Hall, September. I think it was September the 23rd, 1978.
Wow. Oh my God, so visceral as well, and that your spirit.
That's it.
It's
that's
so awful. Lovely to, yeah, visceral, and just to watch you talk about it is so lovely, because that passion, it's just bursting out of you. That you know, it's just who you are, isn't it? It's just music. The last question: your first Glastonbury, what it was like, or what was your best Glastonbury? And that's from Billy.
First Glastonbury, didn't like it. I didn't really like it. We were supposed to do some telly for Channel 4. I've never really got on with doing telly. It's a lot of hanging around and then being told what to do and then do it again. I couldn't get to grips with Glastonbury. I just didn't. I'd been to Reading Festival lots of times. Glastonbury was just, I felt, I guess because it was just, as they say, out of your comfort zone. But I just didn't really like it, to be honest, the first time I went. And there have been odd times in the first in the first few years, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. I'm not saying it was bad. It's just I didn't really get a didn't get a lot out of it. Really. And then I discovered, you know, if you walk through the hedge behind the other stage, then there's a whole other world out of Glastonbury, and it all started making sense. And then you really understand why people were so, you know, love it so passionately and everything. I think it was just that the first year was dry, and it was all right. It was just big. But the next 2 years were really wet, and it was quite a struggle as well. I think trying to make radio shows and yomping around the site in your wellies.
Losing your welly.
Yeah.
I've done that. You take your foot out and the welly's still
that's
there.
Right.
Yeah.
I fell over. I remember walking through to a bit of backstage and looking down and seeing, like, it was like the bottom of, it was just a tree stump. And I thought, someone's going to fall over that this weekend. And sure enough, that someone was me the following day. And I fell face first into the mud, got up and had a sort of raincoaty type of thing on, but just absolutely covered in mud. And then stupidly thought, well, I'll try and wipe some of this mud off. So I reached down, got some straw and tried to rub the mud off, get the mud off with the straw. And the straw just stuck to the coat.
So wattle and daubing yourself.
Yeah. Honestly, by the time I got to the aghast looks, as I finally got back to the BBC compound, I basically looked like Wurzel Gummidge. Straw coming out of the room.
Quite appropriate for Glastonbury. And Steve, are you looking forward to getting back to Six Music in January? Because I know we are.
Yeah, I am. We've sort of worked out a bit of what we're going to do. We haven't quite got everything there yet, but we'll have within the next week or so. But basically, yeah, because I'm being allowed, they're very kindly said, you can basically play, you know, you can choose all the records, and they've given us two sessions a month as well, two live sessions a month, so we can sort of dig into, you know, where people, some of the big artists coming back next year, and, you know, carry on doing what we always do, which is sort of shouting about groups who we think are interesting and that we think people might like. So yeah, no, it's good, and it's been nice having a reset, because doing it for a long time, I did find near the end, because of the amount of music we're being sent, it was becoming a job, an actual just a job, sitting down and listen to this stuff, and it becomes quite relentless. So having a break has been really good for, on a lot of levels, I think, really.
Great. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we've kept you longer than we were meant to, and thank you so much. Absolutely fascinating. And it's, and I mean, I've written down, and I know Esther has, and all the listeners will have loads of bands now to listen to. But thank you so much for giving us your time. It's brilliant to talk to you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for being so generous with your time. We really appreciate
it. Oh, no,
it's been fascinating.
It's been lovely. It's been really, really, really lovely. So thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
You have been listening to Limited Time Only.
Thank you so much to Steve Lamack for being our legendary radio guest. It is so good to hear you back on Six Music, Steve.
Yay! And we hope you enjoyed our Desert Island Disc choices. We would love to know what yours are. Send us your top five on social media. We're on all the platforms that people over 40 know about.
And thank you to all our patrons for your continued support.
Yes, we have got some lovely things over on Patreon, including the next LTO Live Online, which will be very, very soon. So if you want to sign up for that and get involved, then hop over to patreon.com and sign up. We would love to have you with us on Patreon. It's a lot of fun.
And thank you to all of you for listening and your continued support as well. It really means the world to us.
We will see you in 2 weeks' time for the next episode of Limited Time Only, a pick-me-up in podcast form. Right, I'm off to listen to the Archer's Omnibus.
Brilliant. Ta-ra a bit.
Ta-ra.
The shipping car.
The shipping fork.
The shipping fork. The shipping fork.